I can't imagine, I guess. What are the lessons that you learn from taking 30 to 40 people up a mountain and trying to get, there have to be a variety of different skill levels, a variety of different dispositions.
Yeah.
What are the lessons that you've learned from that?
Yeah, so when we take teams of 30 to 40 people up Mount Kilimanjaro, you know, these are people that we meet for the first time. A lot of them are from the state of Arizona, but many of them are from around the world. We've had, you know, people from 19 different countries on our team. The youngest person is 9, the oldest person is 85. And, you know, what I've always said about mountaineering is that the mountain doesn't care where you're from, your age, your title, how much money you have. The mountain doesn't care. And the great thing about mountaineering is that no matter where you come from and what your background is, you know, you have to put forth the effort if you want to be successful. And I think what we've done as a business at K2 Adventure Travel, Kristen and I have created this, what we call a recipe for success.
Hello, this is Paul Johnson. I'm with the Optimistic American, and I am here with an absolutely fascinating guest today, Kevin Chirilla, who is with K2 Adventure Travels. Now, you are going to get to hear some great stories today, stories about ascending Mount Everest and having to work with large groups of people trying to help them on harrowing mountain climbs. But the thing that you're going to hear the most, what I hope it is that you learn today, what it is that you take away from this, is how the lessons that you can learn at 29,800 feet can be just about the same type of lessons that you need, not only in business and to be able to make your ventures work, but oftentimes in everyday life. Kevin is a great storyteller. You're going to be able to enjoy hearing from him. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
All right, so I've got to ask my first one. My first one is, you have a lot of world records. If you would, tell me about those and about the ones that you're the most proud of.
Yeah, you know, my climbing career started with a gentleman who happens to be blind, and his name's Eric Weinmayer. He's a famous blind adventurer, and my adventures around the world started with him in 1993, and it was the first time I'd been around anybody that was blind. My grandfather was disabled, but he was missing a leg, and, you know, so for me to be around people with disabilities was never that big a deal, but to be around somebody like Eric was really awesome. And, you know, we broke several world records over the years climbing with Eric. The first one being he was the first blind person to ever stand on the summit of Mount Everest. So to be a part of that team that broke four other world records was really amazing.
You know, we had the four.
Yeah, so we had the oldest person at the time. His name was Dr. Sherm Bowl. He was 63. We had the first father.
I still have a chance. I'm 63.
Yeah, there you go. Well, I think the record's up to like 79 now.
So we'll have to wait a little while.
That's right. You got to wait a little while. And then the first father and son to stand on top together was Sherm and Brad Bowl. And we took the first HD camera at the time to the summit. And an incredible filmmaker named Michael Brown was a part of that. And then we had, in what I still think is the greatest record of all with that team, was we had the most people from one day reach the summit. And that record still stands. That was 19 people from our team. We had 11 American climbers and then 8 Nepalese Sherpa. So that still holds. And, you know, Time Magazine still says we're the greatest team that's ever climbed Mount Everest. So we take a lot of pride in that.
What year was that?
That was in 2001.
Okay.
Yep. So then over the years, you know, I've been a part of being the expedition leader for some great teams. And I think the most proud I am of a team was when I led 8 blind people to the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro. So, you know, when I went to the Foundation for Blind Children and I said, hey, how would you like to do this as a fundraiser for the foundation? And at first, you know, people thought we were really crazy. You know, they thought we'd be like a circus up there and, you know, blind people don't have any right to be on a mountain. We heard that, you know, they thought we were crazy, like on a suicide mission and all this stuff. And it was just bizarre to hear people talk like that when, you know, here we are raising awareness for an incredible organization, for people that have an amazing ability to do whatever they wanted to do. And to have all 25 people on that team stand on the summit at the same time was incredible. And, you know, that was a really good one. And then several years later, I met a gentleman by the name of Kyle Maynard. Kyle is a prominent disabled athlete. He was born as a quad congenital amputee, meaning his arms were above his elbows and his legs were above his knees. And when we first met Kyle, it was one of those things where he had the ambition, he had the drive, but he just needed the right tools to make it work. And we provided orthotics for him to put over his arms and over his legs that looked just like four hiking boots. And instead of Kyle doing it upright on 2 feet, he did it on all fours and crawled. And you know, after we did Mount Kilimanjaro, he won an ESPY award on ESPN for that, which was pretty amazing, you know, when you think about it, to be recognized as the best male athlete with a disability that year. That was in 2012. And then several years later, we climbed Mount Aconcagua, which is the highest peak in South America. It's the highest peak in the Western Hemisphere. And after that, we were honored with a Nike commercial that aired during the Olympics. So I think when you look back at those teams, you know, those are some of the things that I'm most proud of. And, you know, now it's not always about, you know, doing it with people with disabilities, but it's doing it with people that are, you know, wanting to do something big for themselves and conquer, you know, something different in their life. So.
All right. So that's fascinating. Now, wait a minute. You got blind people up to the top. There have got to be some good stories in that.
Yeah, you know, to get eight blind people to the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro and to work together the way we did as a team, each blind person had two sighted guides. And, you know, we spent about a year training. So there was a lot of, you know, learning curves that we all had to learn, you know, how to communicate with somebody who's blind, how to actually guide them. You know, some people wanted to follow behind listening to bear bells and using two trekking poles. Some people wanted to follow behind by holding on to a backpack and, you know, feeling all the motions of movement and talking to them, step over, you know, big rock left, big rock right, you know, thing. Those were some of the cues. And then some people wanted to hold on to an object that was attached to a backpack. So those were the three methods that we used. And, you know, everyone was super successful as far as achieving that particular goal. And then obviously the foundation achieved an amazing goal. You know, they raised over $1 million for a climb like that, where people thought, again, that we were foolish to do something like that. And, you know, when we were all on the top, it was just a great moment to, you know, reflect on where we came from, where we started from, the achievement that we just accomplished. And, you know, while we were on the top, some funny things that happened being around blind people is, you know, you give them a sign to hold that say, world's, you know, largest group of blind people to stand on the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro, and here they had the sign upside down. You know, things like that, which is really funny. And but for the most part, you know, we had the age of 12-year-olds was our youngest person on that team who was blind. And the oldest one was in his 40s. So to have a great range of people and ability levels and all of that be so successful was really, really rewarding.
All right. So I know that you climbed Mount Everest, correct?
Correct.
Tell me not only the story about the climb itself, but tell me about how you ended up getting to Mount Everest in the first place. What made you decide to do something that crazy?
Yeah, you know, when I at a very young age, when I was 9 years old, I was in third grade, and it was truly my third grade teacher that introduced me to some great adventurers, you know, Shackleton and Sir Edmund Hillary and things like that. And it was just that sense of adventure to go, you know, out of the United States, go to a different part of the world, do something exciting. It was always in the back of my mind. So when I met Eric Weinmayer in 1993, and was a part of, you know, his climbing teams over the years. When we went to Everest in 2001, I was the base camp manager. I didn't have the fortune of climbing with that team, but, you know, my role for that team was very different. And but it was something that I learned a lot from. And then what happened was just a few years later, 6 years later, is when a buddy of mine said, "Hey, are you ready to go do Everest? I'm ready to go. Let's go." And it was, again, one of those things that had been in my mind for 30 years, right? And I watched a lot of Friends, saw some great documentaries about Everest. And, you know, so now I was like, you know what? I've been climbing for about 20 years. I'd like to see, you know, if my skill level was up for it. And, you know, to have a lot of pieces fall into place, you know, not only with my family and my workplace at the time, a lot of things had to come together. And I worked really hard, trained hard for 11 months, and, you know, took off in April of 2007. And, you know, when I climbed it from the north side in Tibet too, which is a little bit different from the south in Nepal. Most people see the iconic photos and things like that of Everest from Nepal. But I wanted to avoid going through the Khumbu Icefall as many times as you have to in order to, you know, be successful on the south side. So I went to the north in Tibet, and it was probably the best decision because even though it's a little more technical and a little harder in certain areas than the south, I think the risk factor of avoiding the Khumbu Icefall, you know, on the south was really what I wanted to do. And the fact that I didn't have that in my mind while I was climbing was really beneficial, I think, to my success.
Mm-hmm. Tell me the story going up. Tell me about the ascent.
Yeah, the ascent was really awesome because we had made a pact with our team of six that we were going to take it slow. We were going to be patient. On the north side, you can be on the mountain into the month of June. In the south side, in Nepal, you have to be off the mountain on May 31st.
What's your acclimation schedule? What do you have to do from an acclimation standpoint?
Yeah, so when we first got there, we spent a few days just at regular base camp at 17,000 feet. And then we worked our way up to advanced base camp, which is at 21,000 feet. And after spending a few days there, we did our first carry up to 23,000 at Camp 1. That's at the North Col. And then from there, we go back down all the way to base camp, back down to 17,000 feet. And that helps our body acclimatize to the altitudes that we have to go to. When you go above 29,000 feet or even above 26,000 feet, which is considered the death zone, you know, it's really important to acclimatize properly. So we spent a lot of time going, you know, back up to interim base camp and then moving up to Camp 2. And when we moved up to Camp 2 for the first time, we were going on our summit push. We were just going to go from 2 to 3 to the summit. But what happened?
Without stopping?
Without, you know, we're just sleeping one night and okay. Then just keep going. So when we got to Camp 2 at 25,200 feet, the weather really turned for the worse. And we were shooting for a May 24th summit. But instead, we decided to go all the way back down to base camp at 17,000 feet and wait for about a week for this a better weather window. So we were actually shooting for June the 4th to reach the summit, but on our way back up, we decided to take an extra acclimatization day. We spent two nights at Camp 1 hoping for that better weather window, and that's exactly what happened. You know, so we moved up to Camp 2. We moved up to Camp 3 at 27,300 feet, and that was really crazy, spending a night there that high. And
what is that like, spending a night at 27,000 feet?
Yeah, you know, the weather was, it got down to minus 51 degrees, but there was no wind. And it was truly, when we left our tent at midnight, the weather was absolutely gorgeous. There was no wind, a lot of stars, and it was just really cold. And we just knew that if we set out at a good pace, and we kept moving, we stay hydrated, that we should have a really successful day. We had the mountain to ourselves. All the other teams had left.
27,000 feet. At 19,000 feet on Kilimanjaro, I couldn't sleep before that last little bit.
Yeah.
So can you even sleep at 27,000 feet?
No, you know what? We had a horrible night of sleep. You know, we were at such an angle, and I had stacked up about 9 oxygen bottles just to make it kind of level. My buddy Gavin and I, who I was sharing a tent with, we also decided to take one sleeping bag and sleep in our down suits and use the sleeping bag as a blanket. So you can imagine being at 27,200 feet, minus 50 degrees, you know, all the cooking that we had to do, boiling water. You know, we didn't sleep at all. By the time we got done boiling water for dinner and eating dinner, you know, we closed our eyes maybe for 3 hours and, you know, got up at 11, started getting to, you know, all of our stuff put together, our backpacks, and the oxygen bottles that we needed to take because we carried three bottles each. Each bottle weighs 10 pounds, almost 10 pounds. So to carry 30 pounds plus water, plus snacks, some of the other things that we had, you know, that's a lot of weight to be carrying at that altitude. Mm-hmm. So after we got ready and moved out the door, you know, it was the next 20 hours is what my summit day
from
was.
27,000 feet, it's a 20-hour hike still?
Yeah, well, not to the summit. It took us about 7.5 hours to get to the summit.
Okay.
I only spent about 10 minutes up there because the winds we knew later in the day were going to get worse. Okay. I could hear the jet stream just above my head. So when you hear, you know, winds.
What does that sound like?
Like a freight train.
You know,
yeah, with a big loud horn. You know, when wind's moving about 200 miles an hour and you can actually hear it, and it's pretty eerie knowing that if that level was to drop to the level we were at on the mountain, it would blow us off like ragdolls, you know. So we literally spent 10 minutes on the top. I was there alone with my Sherpa. And, you know, on the way down, it was a crazy story because
get a picture?
Yeah, you know, the funny thing was
Before phones, right?
Yeah, this was before phones, and I had carried a camera. And the fortunate or unfortunate thing was before it froze, my Sherpa took three photos. His finger was covering my face the first time, so like my head was chopped off. His finger was covering about half of my body on the second one. And then on the third one, he had his finger in the corner, but he didn't block me out. So it was easy to put in the sky than it was to create a person. So that was literally the only three photos I got. I took some video as well, which turned out real nice before that camera froze. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I did get that footage. You know, and I always look back on that, you know, and it wasn't a selfish thing that I did. It was just one of those things where, you know, I wanted to prove to myself that I had the skill set to do that. And
now, you're going by, as I've read, one of my favorite books of all time is Into Thin Air.
Yeah.
But you're going by, like, people who haven't made it.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah, you know, as I entered Camp 3 was the first time I encountered a gentleman that had passed away about 2 weeks prior. And we literally had to step over him to get to where our tents were at. We were on fixed lines, and this gentleman had passed away. And the unfortunate thing, the year I was there were 7 deaths. Several people that I had seen quite a bit of the time I was there, a gentleman from Japan who had passed away on the way down from the summit just a few days prior to us going, and had to walk past him as well. So, yeah, you know, it was one of those things. It's a grim reminder of, you know, if you're not on, if you're not reading your body, and if you just don't have it that day, you know, don't force yourself to do something you can't do.
What's the rule? Do they ever come back up and pick them up, or do they just leave them there?
No, they just leave them there. It's very difficult to take somebody down at a certain altitude. A lot of times they get covered with rock and, you know, given a proper ceremony. Sometimes they're moved or, you know, pushed off into a crevasse to, you know, to be off a trail or for where someone doesn't have to look at them or be a part of stepping over them, which, mm-hmm. you know, is a lot of dignity there that, you know, mm-hmm. you don't, you know, want to have on, you know, you just, you want to have some dignity towards that mm-hmm. person. So
you do 20 hours after you leave 27,000 feet. When were you the most exhausted, when you were getting to the top or coming back down?
No, coming back down, because my second bottle of oxygen, I went to use it and hear the thread on the top of it to put on my regulator on it. That thread was stripped. So when I put my regulator on it, the air just hissed out in about 20 minutes. So I literally went from about 28,900 feet down to 20,000 feet with no more oxygen. So that's the unfortunate thing about that day, but, you know, to have to pick up all of my gear at Camp 3 and then carry that down to Camp 2. And the unfortunate thing, my buddy Gavin, who went with me, did not make it. So he didn't carry anything down. So it was kind of like I picked up a lot of, you know, stuff that was left back at camp. So to go from 27,200 feet to the summit all the way back down to 25,000 feet at Camp 2, it was a 20-hour day. I had about 60 to 80 pounds in my backpack,
wow.
you know, by the time I got down to Camp 2. And, you know, when I was there, I was super exhausted. The sun was ready to go down, and it turned really, really cold once the sun went down, and being exhausted and not having a whole lot of nutrition in me. I just remember getting in the tent, and two other teammates were in the tent. They'd already boiled some water, and which is really nice to get the warmth back in my body again. And boy, did we sleep well that night, you know.
So, I'll be darned. Yeah. All right. So, so I want to go to the business part. By the way, it's an amazing business that you've built.
Yeah.
But I imagine, I can't imagine, I guess. What are the lessons that you learned from taking 30 to 40 people up a mountain and trying to get, there have to be a variety of different skill levels, a variety of different dispositions.
Yeah.
What are the lessons that you've learned from that?
Yeah. So when we take teams of 30 to 40 people up Mount Kilimanjaro, you know, these are people that we meet for the first time. A lot of them are from the state of Arizona, but many of them are from around the world. We've had, you know, people from 19 different countries on our team. The youngest person is 9. The oldest person is 85. And, you know, what I've always said about mountaineering is that the mountain doesn't care where you're from, your age, your title, how much money you have. The mountain doesn't care. And the great thing about mountaineering is that no matter where you come from and what your background is, you know, you have to put forth the effort if you want to be successful. And I think what we've done as a business at K2 Adventure Travel, Kristen and I have created this, what we call a recipe for success. And, you know, it's number one, learning the skill sets of all the people on your team. It's just talking to them and interviewing them about, you know, what's your everyday activity like, and, you know, what do you want to get out of this climb? And you kind of figure out, you know, a little bit about where everybody's at, and, you know, because everybody's doing it for a different reason. And, you know, a couple of the things that we've always done is, you know, we just tell everybody, you know, be present in the moment. Don't worry about what's going on back home. Don't worry about your family. Don't worry about your business. Be present. Be in the moment with the team. And, you know, when we get people that are able to do that for 7 days climbing Kili and doing something, you know, beyond extraordinary that they've ever done before, physically, mentally, and emotionally, you know, it works. And, you know, this recipe that we've put together about, you know, taking it one step at a time, being present in the moment, don't worry about the summit if it's 3 or 4 days away. Just worry about today. And what we try to tell them is, like, for example, on day one, you're going from 6,000 feet at the gate. Camp one is 10,000 feet. You know, we're going to hike for 6 hours. It's, you know, we're going to cover 4,000 feet in elevation. And this is what you expect when you get into camp. And I think that, you know, pacing it out that way and spreading it out that way and having them understand that, hey, we're just going to talk about today. We're not going to worry about anything else. And we're going to work together as a team. That's the other big key is, you know, a lot of times we get these 30, 40 people teams and, you know, they're coming from all different, you know, places around the world. They all have different agendas, but we try to tell them, hey, we're all here for the same reason. And that reason to me is you want to stand on the summit and you want to do it safely and you want to be successful doing that. So guess what we're going to do? We're going to do it as a team. We're going to go at our pace. You're not going to go, you know, faster than the lead guide. And sometimes that's really hard for people. You know, we get people that are, you know, these extreme athletes or they're runners or, you know, they work and live in a high pace society and they just don't know how to, you know, to shut it off or to close it down a little bit.
The lead person.
Well, it's just, it's really not an option. You know, it's just, we just tell them, hey, you know, we have a lead Tanzanian guide and then one of our K2 guides or myself, or Kristen will take the next spot and we try to keep everybody together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's power in people, there's power in that line of people being together. And, you know, we take a break every hour. So when during that hour, people get to chat with one another. We ask them how they're feeling, how they're doing.
Did you ever read The Adventure to the South Pole by the first two explorers?
No,
it sounds a lot like them. It's a fascinating story. And one of them just decided to go as far as he could, as fast as he could, with as much as he could. And the other one, who was, I believe, Scandinavian, made the decision to go only 20 miles a day. And he would only go those 20 miles a day, which you would have thought he would have lost. But by pacing it out, sleeping, getting his rest, eating when they were supposed to, they overwhelmingly beat the other team. In fact, the other team perished. But it was just interesting hearing you talk about almost exactly the same lessons you could have picked up from them.
Yeah, you know, we try to really instill patience in people, and it's sometimes that's really hard for people to have patience and slow their life down a little bit. And in the mountains, that's the great thing is, you know, you put somebody on a regimen and you just tell them this is how it's going to be. And if they can settle their mind and just trust the process, they'll be absolutely fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our success rate on Kilimanjaro is over 96%. And, you know, to take people that, you know, some people literally start as couch potatoes with us. You know, it's an idea that they've had. Maybe it's a family member that's dragged them into it or whatever. But if you're willing to work with that person who, you know, is that couch potato or doesn't have a whole lot of experience doing something physical or, you know, mental as this or going to these altitudes, if they're willing to listen, those are the best people that you want because, you know, they trust you first because once you have a track record that we have with, you know, I have 43 summits of Kilimanjaro and I've led several thousand people up there now. So it's kind of like, you know, yeah, you can go onto the internet and you can read all these stories about other people's experience or whatever, but that's not the K2 experience. And that's what we really try to tell people. Hey, don't read everything and believe everything that you see on the internet. You know, if you have a true question, ask us. And having a business partner who's a female who's now done it 21 times and has more summits than any female in the world, to have a woman ask me a question or to have that person ask Kristen, sometimes, you know, you have best of both worlds, right? You know, a female wants to get a perspective from a female who's done it. And, you know, I'm able to add the experience of, wow, I've done this a lot. And it has nothing to do with how many summits I have. It's always about the team. Mm-hmm. You know, people always ask me, why do you go back? Why do you do it so many times? Isn't it boring? And I'm like, no, it has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with how many summits I've had. It has to do with the team that we've just put together. And that's truly what we work on. And, you know, as we move up the mountain, if somebody is struggling, we have, you know, everything put into place to whether we have to take their backpack and help them carry it for a few days. You know, if someone gets sick, we're like, hey, you know, this is the regimen that you should take to get better. And people really appreciate that. And the attention to detail before we leave, you know, training, what's the packing list? You know, what can you expect? All of those things from good weather to bad weather. And I think that's what people really appreciate. And that's one of the reasons why we are so successful.
All right. You have, I know one of your rules is walking beside your team. What does that mean?
Yeah. So if I take sweep, which I love to do, being the last person, you know, I love observing people to see how they're reacting to the conditions, to the altitude, to the rigors of, you know, mountain climbing. And one of the things I'll do is as we walk, you know, we create a pace that's very slow. So to be able to walk next to people and to walk through the line and up the line to see how everybody's doing and to add that personal attention to every person. Hey, how you feeling? You know, great smile today. You look great. You know, you're feeling strong or whatever it may be. You know, hey, how you feeling? If someone says, you know, I just don't have it in me right now. And I said, fine, we'll take care of your pack. Maybe you have to slow down a little bit. And that's the other nice thing is if someone, we tell people right away, it's not a competition. You know, it's not about the first person who stands there. It's just, let's see if we can get everybody there together at the same time, feeling the same way. And I think that's what it means to walk next to your group. And, you know, I think all of these principles that we use, you know, not only they benefit my business, but we always tell people when you come back from one of these trips, you're going to have a different focus in your life and you're going to have a different hop in your giddy up that, you know, you may not be able to see, but people around you will see. And the next time I see you, you will be a different person. And I think that's what's so great about mountaineering and taking these people that, you know, from a lot of experience down to no experience and watching them go through that change.
You know, the goals that I know that you set, they all just apply to business as far as I'm concerned. They're the exact same standards that you would want. Keeping the goals manageable,
right?
That whole concept, it's so important inside a company because you can get way out in front of, as they say, your supply lines, as the Russians are dealing with today.
Yeah.
But you can get way ahead of your group of people who all have a variety of different talents, and you have to make certain that you are able to deal with it in that way. I love the having fun. I think having fun is one of the most important things you can do in business.
Yeah.
If people aren't having fun, you just simply won't get them to produce as much. I love walk beside your team.
Yeah.
Walking beside your team, that's how we, you know, it's each one's touching one. It's that at the end of the day, this is about the human relationship that exists between us. And then you're maintaining the standard.
Right.
Right. You have to set a standard in business for what it is that you want or in the hike. And then you have to follow it. A brand doesn't matter if you decide that you're not going to live up to it, that you're not going to follow the standard.
Right.
A brand is usually about something that you're willing to lose everything for. You're willing to give things up for. And to me, you know, as I'm listening to you talk about that hike, that's kind of what they're talking about. Hey, if we don't maintain the standard, people could lose their lives. It can be a serious type of event. And in business, maybe you don't lose your life, but you can certainly lose the thing that you started with.
Right.
I think those are wonderful standards that you've set. Do you try to follow through on those in your business as well?
100%. You know, we love to have fun. You know, one of the things we love doing with our teams is everybody gets a nickname and they earn it. You know, it's something they say or something they do. And we do that to have fun and to make when we get into camp and we change out of our clothes that we've been wearing all day long and we get into those evening clothes and we go into that dining tent. You know, this is where we want to hear from people. You know, how did you feel today? What were some wins? You know, and what were some setbacks that, you know, you want to share? And we have this dialogue with people, and I think they really appreciate that. I think a lot of times, you know, in business, you know, employers or bosses don't listen to their employees or don't spend that time to really get to know how they're feeling. And in the mountain where, yes, your life is on the line at times, you want to know how those people are feeling and you want to know how to change their outlooks or their attitudes or, you know, maybe those disbeliefs that they still have in their mind. So the next day that they wake up with, you know, a little more energy and a little more rambunction to go and, you know, they feel more confident in themselves, you know, hey, I've just achieved, you know, my personal high at 12,500 feet today. And man, I can't wait to go higher. You know, I feel really good. So whatever it is, you know, that's the atmosphere that we try to create, you know, and if you step into our office, into our business, you know, you're always greeted with a open arm, smiling face. You know, we love to have people, you know, follow along what we're doing, be a part of what we're doing because they want to be with us. You know, they see that we're happy, fun people and not, you know, someone they don't want to be around. And, you know, when you invest what people invest in us for a trip and everything that goes into that, it's not just a cost value of the trip. There's a lot more to it. And there's not one person over the years that can say that they didn't get something out of the trip. You know, and I think that's what I take the most pride in is the fact that we create, you know, an atmosphere, an opportunity, and that people can take something from it. And if they don't, then I say that we failed at what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they take it from the culture, whether they take it from the people, whether they take it from us directly or somebody else on the team, you know, it doesn't matter where it comes from. I just know that it's going to make them a better person when they get back home.
All right, so you follow your dream and you end up getting up to the top of Everest. And then over time, you take that dream and you turn it into an actual business,
yeah.
Something that you can do that you love and you love doing. I know that when you've done as many trips as you have done, there are always things you didn't plan for, things that go wrong, and you have to deal with those things. I also know business can be exactly the same way.
Yeah.
You can end up hitting those issues that you would have never dreamed this could have been true. Now, the pandemic had a significant impact on a lot of businesses. I can't imagine it didn't have a big one on yours. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, when COVID hit, you know, March of 2020, you know, pretty much during the time of when that hit, we already had most of our clients already, you know, signed up, ready to go on one of our trips. And then here, you know, the whole world's turned upside down. We lost about 82% of our revenue for that year. Let's just say that. So that's a big loss.
82%, that's a huge loss.
Yeah, so that is a big loss. So what we decided then was, okay, well, we can't do international. So what are we going to do? We put our heads together and we said, you know what? We have an amazing state of Arizona that we live in, and there's so many opportunities here, and we always have run trips to the Grand Canyon. So we said, you know what? Let's add some more Grand Canyon trips on the docket, because people were willing to travel locally. And then we also got involved with some other local high schools that wanted us to run service trips for them. So instead of us just, you know, cowering and, you know, feeling sorry for ourselves that we lost our business, we said, hey, you know what, let's find a way to not only take care of the people that had signed up for us and what can we do for them. So as a business, you know, we took a lot of pride in the fact that we told people, hey, you know, you can use your deposits or you can use your payments for the next 2 years on any trip. You know, we know that this isn't going to last forever. And so we made them feel comfortable with their investment first, right? So the majority of the people kept their money with us, and they said, you know, we're going to travel with you when this opens back up. We did have to give, you know, refunds to people, because we also said, hey, you know what? We don't have control over this, and we feel really bad about it. But so if you want a refund, we'll give you that
okay,
too.
But a business that just lost 80% of its revenue,
yeah,
and then having to give people back money, my guess is you were digging into your own pocket?
At one time we did.
Yeah.
Yep. And then we were very fortunate that a lot of people just wanted to carry it over. And then once we picked up the other business, staying local here, it really helped with finances, mm-hmm. you know. And then 2021, we had a bigger rebound. You know, I think it's, you know, how everybody really reacted to the pandemic. And that is, you know, some people still didn't feel comfortable going out. Some people were really ready to go out, right? So they're like, man, once the floodgates open to do things, and as countries opened up and lessened their restrictions on travel, man, we really had those people that wanted to go. And now looking at, you know, 2 years later in 2022, we're probably going to have our biggest year. So I think it was just, you know, we have this brand and we have a solid commitment to the people that really believe in us and really want to travel with us. And we showed them that, you know, hey, we are going to be true to our word, and, you know, we'll let you carry your money through. And I think it's just snowball effect. You know, now pretty much every place is open. There are still a few restrictions. You know, flights have opened up a lot more, and the testing to get in and out of countries has diminished a little bit. So I think as the world starts to change now, you know, I think we're at the top of that wave, riding it again, and really looking forward to 2022 and 23.
Okay, but this lesson of having to deal with the pandemic, all of us have to deal with it in different ways mm-hmm. in life and in our business. There had to be one day where you knew, uh-oh, and panic started to set in.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that day?
Yeah, it was when it was right around the same time when, you know, the pandemic hit, people started shutting down. Well, we worked with an organization that filed for bankruptcy, and we had just given them a $30,000 check for a group flight ticket. So this group flight had to do with about 20 people on one ticket. Each value of those tickets ranged from about $1,800 to $2,500. And so when you're looking at a $30,000 ticket that we just paid and they file for bankruptcy and you lose that, you know, that was probably our low point.
Okay.
Yeah.
What do you do then? I mean, how do you get control back over yourself, and what do you start doing to make that work?
Yeah. You know, I think it was the great communication that we had with all of our clients. Like, hey, we know the situation that you're in, but here's the situation that we're in tenfold, right? So when we put out, a professional email that stated, this is what we're trying to do for everybody, and this is how we're going to accommodate you right now. If you want a refund, we'll give you that. Or if you see the situation that we're in and you want to just hold your money with us, you know, that's basically what we told people, is that we're still going to be here when this is over with. We're not going to fold. You know, our track record held true to that.
I love these lessons. Don't panic.
Yeah.
It's definitely one of the lessons. Communicate with people. Be honest.
Yeah.
Right? It's amazing how understanding people can be when you're honest. I suspect some of those people who said, I'll just let it ride, were letting it ride because they had faith in you. It was trust.
100%.
They had begun to build up with you, and they believed that you were going to take care of them. But then you kind of get to that next point, which is focus on what you do. and you started looking for, hey, what are alternatives? I can't do A, so what is B, C, and D?
Yeah.
What are my alternative choices? So you start doing the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, I've done rim to rim to rim. That's all you can do anyway.
Right? Yeah. I mean,
yeah. At rim to rim, you're at your, well, at least for me, I was at my extreme.
Yeah. Well, you know, even the Grand Canyon had restrictions. You know, they allow us to take groups of 30 people at one time, and then they knocked that down to 10 people at one time, right? So with that being said, we just had to say, okay, well, if we can only take 10, then we'll just take more groups, you know? And literally, we had teams running most of May, most of September and October, and, you know, so that was one way to keep us going. Mm-hmm. And you know, and like you said, there are people out there that fully understood what we as a travel company were going through. And many of our clients, about 80% of our clients, go on more than one trip. And we've had people do all of our trips. You know, we go to multiple places around the world. So, you know, that trust was already built with a lot of people. You know, the only unfortunate thing is we had a team of about 30 people from outside of the United States. They were all from other countries. So now, not only did we have to learn about what are the restrictions in the United States, we had to learn about what are the restrictions in Germany and Taiwan and Singapore and Malaysia and all these other countries where we have clients from. You know, some of them are still on restrictions, or, you know, they still have different restrictions leaving their country and coming back than what we do. So, you know, to have everybody understand and try to put the pieces back together for everybody from other countries too has taken a few years. And, you know, we still have some people that, you know, are going to travel with us, but they're going to carry it over to next year, 2023.
So, all right. So part of what you're giving to people is the ability to be a greater version of themselves.
Yeah.
What I'm impressed by is that you've become the embodiment of that. You've, mm-hmm. you've embodied that value. Talk about that for a little bit, if you would. What is important in that, and how do you accomplish what it is that you want within those goals or parameters?
Yeah, I think that when you're able to take somebody that has, you know, maybe teetering or wavering a little bit on their confidence, and you can say to them, you know, I don't know exactly how much this is going to impact you when you come back, but I'm almost guaranteed that when you come back, you are going to be a better version of yourself than when you left. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, just training in general. You know, we get a lot of people that overcome hurdles just in the training process. Number one, maybe losing some weight that they've, you know, always wanted to get rid of but didn't know how to. Maybe changing their lifestyle to how they plan their day, right? You know, I was told a long time ago as a high school athlete that the only common thing that everybody in the world has is time. We all have the same amount of time. There's 24 hours in a day, that's it. And how you utilize your time is what makes you more successful sometimes over than someone else. And, you know, to have people say, wow, I had to refocus. Instead of getting out of bed at 8 o'clock in the morning, I got up at 5 and I worked out and I ate a little bit differently than I did before because I see the benefits of eating healthier, right? All of those things. And then when you get somebody that, you know, has already been changed before you go and they get on a team call and they share their wins with people, you know, it kind of lifts the spirits of everybody, right? Mm-hmm. And then you go over and you're standing at the base of Mount Kilimanjaro and you're looking up at the largest freestanding mountain in the world. And sometimes that really freaks people out. You know, they kind of like psych themselves out before they even start, or you hear the murmurs of, wow, I don't know if I'm going to ever be able to do that.
It
right?
goes from horizon to horizon.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, as far as you can see in either direction.
Yeah. And the great thing about that is, and now you have the discussion with them of, hey, you know what? Don't think about the summit. Yeah, everybody can stand there and look how far that up is, how high up that is. But if you take it one step at a time, 1 hour at a time, one day at a time, eventually you're going to be on the top. And sometimes what people learn in that process is their life is a rat race. You know, from the time they get up, you know, you get these moms or you get dads that go on these trips, or you get students that are so busy that they don't know how to calm themselves down, or they've never had a peaceful moment in their day. And to say to them, hey, your peace is going to happen on the mountain they kind of look at you like you're crazy, right? But then once you get into the moment and you start walking and the first day is through a rainforest, most people have never walked through a rainforest before. So when you see them looking around and, you know, they realize that they're in the moment and they're present in the moment, that has a little mind shift to them, right? And then you go to day two and you go to day three and all of a sudden, you know, day six is summit day. And, you know, you got to get up early in the morning and sometimes it's really, really cold and, you know, it's dark and you have all these things that, man, I've never been out of bed before light or I've never, you know, slept at 16,000 feet before. For some people, that's like the biggest challenge. How am I going to, you know, get through that mental block of sleeping at 16,000 feet for a night and then have to go up to 19,400 feet to stand on the summit? Well, if you break it down for them and you tell them what it's going to be like and that we're going to be right here with you and we're all going to stay together as a team and we're going to monitor your health along the way and we're not going to let you get to a point where you're going to die, you know, because that's in people's mind. After you're done doing that and you come down off that mountain and you have that team celebration and whether they made it to the summit or not, and our success rate is really high, we tell people you climbed that mountain for 7 days. You know, you did something that less than 1% of the population of the world ever even tries, you know? So
when you're doing all those things to slow it down and to make certain they feel comfortable, are you still also helping push them or getting them to
sure.
push themselves? And is that important?
It's really important. You know, you know, you get someone who, let's just say they get an upset stomach or they get diarrhea and they have it coming out both ends and you just look at them like, okay, well, this doesn't mean turnaround for you. This means you got to dig deep. You got to dig real deep. You know, if you truly want to stand on the summit, you know, I'll let you know what you have to do along the way. If you're still losing fluids, we'll pump them back in you and we'll monitor you. But you know what? You can still do it. You know, or sometimes you get people that, you know, they get a really bad headache or just not feeling up to snuff on that particular day. You try to make them feel the best they can for that moment. Let them know you're there to support them. And there's others there to support
too. Isn't
that
part of the experience also, though, is getting through those adversities and being successful?
Yeah. Anytime you get through an adversity and you're successful, or anytime, even if you don't succeed and reach the top, I've told people I've walked off of many mountains in training. And they, you know, some people look at it as a failure. And it's like, no, that's not a failure. It's a learning lesson. Like, what could I have done different? What could I have done in preparation better? What could I have done different with my gear? You know, so there's learning lessons always along the way. And literally when people come down, man, it's just, I love sharing stories about, you know, people that didn't think they had it in them, questioned everything along the way or leading up to that point. And then they come down and they just have a different walk about them or have a different talk about them. Or now when they go to work, they take on leadership roles or they're not afraid to speak up or, you know, look at things a little differently or have patience with something. You know, we get people that, especially business owners, I love these guys that are business owners and their life is a rat race. And, man, they come back and they tell you several months afterwards, wow, I really learned a lot. I shared this with my employees or I shared this with my executive team or whatever it is, and they have a shift in their business for the better.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, I think about this lesson and how it applies to life. I really believe that resilience is one of our big keys in life. It's our ability to be able to deal with adversity that makes us stronger. I have a lot of people, young people who work for me, and then I have grandchildren and children, and I'm constantly dealing with people who often look for safety. They look for that place where they're going to feel comfortable.
Right.
The reality is that that's not what life is really supposed to give you. It's supposed to make you strong, and that happens through struggle and through adversity.
Yeah.
It never fails when I'm able to convince people to abandon a little bit of safety.
Yeah.
For growth, and they go through that adversity, that they're always happy when it gets done. And that can range in terms of, you know, that could be climbing a mountain, that could be, a run that they're going to do, but it also can be trying something in business that they haven't tried. Being an entrepreneur, I don't care who you are. When you go in and become an entrepreneur, you go to all the business classes you want to. It's still an experience when you still step out and you're the one who's putting it all together.
Right.
But when you get done going through it, it enriches your life so much. And again, that can go down to just knowing how to have a conversation with someone that you disagree with.
Right.
You know, so many people say, well, they made me feel uncomfortable in what they had to say.
Yeah.
Well, good. Uncomfortable is kind of what we're after.
Yeah.
If we become uncomfortable, we grow, we learn something. And by learning something, we become better. To me, that's one of the more wonderful lessons, I think, that you've been able to put forward.
Yeah, and we tell people, you know, you are stepping out of your comfort zone and you are going to be uncomfortable at times. And, you know, when you have to pull down your pants and go to the bathroom in, you know, 20-degree weather with the wind blowing sideways, I guarantee a lot of people have never done that before, right? Uh-huh. But and that's, you know, how does that apply to business or whatever? But you know what? It's just, it's one of those things where it just took them out of their comfort zone for a short period of time and they realized that, hey, that taking me out of my comfort zone for a short period of time was okay. You know, it is okay.
What was your worst day on any mountain?
Well, you know, my very first trip to Aconcagua in South America, I spent 9 out of 10 days in a tent straight, where we had to get out every few hours and, you know, take the snow off our tent and make sure it didn't collapse and things like that. So it's, you know, you learn patience very quickly. And I think, you know, all walks of life, no matter what you do as a parent, as a business owner, as a, you know, just a student, whatever it may be, I think people really lack patience. And to be able to create patience in people sometimes is like a true gift, right? You know, and how do you do that? Well, you read a book or you listen to music or you, you know, just... Some people have just never spent time alone by themselves with nothing to do. You know, we always want to be entertained in some way or another. But when you go into the mountains, sometimes just sitting on a rock looking at a horizon is like so peaceful and calm that, you know, you generate a lot of thought and, you know, a lot of great business ideas. You know, there's so many things that come from that, you know. So I think that was one lesson learned. Another one was when I was going to the summit of Everest, we knew that in order to reach the summit on the day that we did, we had to go through a really bad storm, because we knew that the calm after the storm was going to be, you know, the fruit of the reward of standing on the summit of Everest, right? So when we were moving back up to camp two, we had to endure winds between 90 and 100 miles an hour.
Oh, wow. That almost can't take you off the mountain.
It can totally take you off the mountain. So I'll never forget, I was on a fixed line and I knelt down and I took my backpack off and I said, I had my camera in my backpack and I said, I've got to record this. Like, this may be the only time in my entire life that I'll ever be in weather like this. But I also know that if I don't go through something like this, there's no way I'm going to reach the summit of Everest. So I think going through that day really taught me a lot about, you know, just kind of like survival, being in the right frame of mind. You know, how do you push through something like this, knowing that it will be better in the end instead of turning around and, you know, throwing in the towel. So I think that was probably one of the biggest things I learned in the mountains was on that particular day. And to be able to videotape is that I share that, you know, I do presentations to corporations and to schools and to people wanting a motivational speaker. And, you know, I share that. And I do talk about sometimes you have to weather a storm in order to reap the benefits of what you're truly wanting to get, you know. And it's amazing to watch people during those storms and in the eye of the storm, what do they really do? You know, are they on your side? Are they by your side? Are they supporting you? Do they quit? Do they turn around? You know, or do they stick together with you, come up with a plan that, you know, that we will be successful, you know, and you know, again, you can apply that to business. And, you know, those are just some great lessons that, you know, I've always taken with me, and they happen in the mountains. And
yeah, it's wonderful that we haven't created so many rules that it stops people from being able to do things to reach their dreams. I think that's important.
Yeah.
I also am interested in, you know, there's a lot of controversy going on in our country, especially as it relates to politics. But you see people in a very different way, lots and lots of people in very different positions. Has that made you more pessimistic about who we are or more optimistic? And why?
You know, I think it makes me more optimistic about people. You know, I love learning about new cultures, new ways, new ideas about things. And in a lot of times people don't sit and listen long enough to get to know somebody. You know, I always talk about being a sponge, you know, to go into a meeting and or go into a presentation of somebody and just sit and listen and absorb as much as you can. And I think what I've learned over the years, it doesn't matter what language you speak, where you come from, how much money you have, male or female, you know, if you're willing to, you know, listen to people, accept the differences in people, you don't always have to agree with them, but it does make you a stronger person, mm-hmm. you know. And I've been blessed to have many clients and many friends from other countries and to learn about their cultures and what they stand for and what makes them tick in business. And, you know, you learn a lot that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you're willing to listen, man, it's an opportunity for growth in myself and our company. And, you know, you create these relationships with people. And, you know, the great thing is when you talk about people changing, coming off the mountains, what they do is they want to come back, and then they want to come back with their teams. They want to come back with the people they work with. They want to come back with their family members. So that's another way that our company has grown over the years.
You've created a charity also, I believe, right? Talk a little about that.
Yeah, so we have a nonprofit organization called K2 Adventures Foundation. It's our not-for-profit arm of our company, and what we do with that is we have many components to that, and the majority of it stays right here in Arizona, the money that we raise. But we do have between 30% and 40% of our money goes internationally, and I've always been under the belief that if I'm going to go to a country and take something from them, I want to be able to give something more back. And what we do now is, like in Tanzania, we have an orphanage. We have 10 little kids that we take care of. We have 2 hospitals that we support. We're creating this new adventure.
How's the orphanage funded?
It's through our foundation.
Funding. How is the foundation funded? I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the foundation is funded many different ways. One is we have 3 fundraising events that we do here in Arizona. We also have our travel clients that go with us that see all the beautiful things that we do in these countries and how we give back, whether it's through education or whether it's through our work in these hospitals and giving back to the community. We're building a women's shelter. So they donate. You know, last year we had about $180,000 donated to our foundation through our travel company. And what a great concept to be able to be surrounded by people that love adventure, love taking on a challenge, but also love to give back. Mm-hmm. And that's truly the type of people that we bring into our organization are people that love to travel and do amazing adventures, you know, try something they may never have before, and then also give back to the things that we believe so strongly in our heart. One of the great things that we're opening this year is a prosthetic center, and this will be in Arusha, Tanzania. It's going to be at NSK Hospital with our partners there, and our goal is to provide every person in the continent of Africa that's lost a leg a new prosthetic leg. And we're going to start this summer with the local people in Arusha and Moshi, Tanzania. And our goal is to get, there's been about 600 people.
That's an amazing moonshot.
Yeah. You know, there's been 600 people in that area alone that's been designated as someone with a limb loss that we can put a prosthetic on. And our goal in the next year is to provide all 600 people with a leg.
All right. So K2 Adventures Travels.
Yep.
What are we going to see from you all in the future, both in terms of you and your life and your company? What do you think we're going to see coming up?
Yeah, you know, we're going to continue to take people on these great adventures. We're going to continue to grow our foundation in the places that we serve. In Nepal, we've built some incredible schools in regions where people don't want to build schools for these kids. And we've created these amazing schools in the Khumbu Valley where they now have internet service where they can be connected to other schools, both, you know, in the valley or around the world. So we're super excited about that. You know, we have found a recipe for success for where we go, and that's what we like to stick with. And, you know, we don't expand too far out as far as where we go with these adventures, but what we do for these countries, we're going to continue. We have a global ed program where we have now 31 students of porters and guides of ours in Tanzania, where we've put them in private education. And our goal for them is to get the best education possible so they can give back to their community when they graduate from college. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, and we've had one Tanzanian come to the United States, to Grand Canyon University, become educated. She's gone back to Tanzania, and now she runs a business with her father. So that's what we want to see, and that's what we're going to continue to grow.
So you spent a lifetime helping other people get to their bucket list items.
Yeah.
Do you have anything left in your bucket list?
You know, I've never really considered what I do in life as a bucket list. I kind of take on challenges as they're presented.
Uh-huh.
I do have some places that I would love to just – I've never spent any time on a beach in an ocean somewhere exotic.
Uh-huh.
You know,
Yours are always hard stuff.
Mine are always the hard stuff, the high stuff, the cold stuff. So eventually someday, if I ever decide to slow down.
Your idea of a wonderful vacation is about 20 degrees below zero with 90 degree gale winds.
Yep. I do love the fish. So I always talk about, you know, when I do go to places, you know, I'd love to throw in some fishing here and there. And,
yeah. All right. How do we get a hold of your company? What's the website?
Yeah.
And phone number.
Yeah. So please, if you have an opportunity, go to K2AdventureTravel.com is our travel company, and K2Adventures.org is our foundation. And you can see all the places we go, all the great work that we do. You can also call me at any time at 602-686-6146 and ask me anything you want about the travel company or the foundation. And I love to do corporate speaking. You know, that's another big thing. You know, people love to hear the story from, you know, the person maybe with a disability or the person that won the championship or was a, you know, a great leader of the world. But sometimes they love to hear from the person who's behind the scenes making it all happen. And,
yeah.
and that's what I consider myself a behind the scenes person. You know, even though I think leadership happens at the back of the line as much as it does at the front of the line. And, you know, I love sharing that story too, is, you know, what goes on behind the scenes to be a great leader.
Well, Kevin, you are certainly a great leader, wonderful company. I'm so glad you guys are around. We're going to do a trip with K2 Adventures. I'm excited about it. But thank you very much for coming on The Optimistic American.
Thanks for having me, Paul. Appreciate it.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Is that good?
Yeah, very nice.
Great.
Yeah.